Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Matt Schwartz. He's Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association, an organization founded to protect habitat, wilderness, and biodiversity in the greater Everglades. Over the years, he's been involved in numerous battles over management of public lands, energy projects, habitat development, and Everglades restoration. So thank you so much, A, for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
So tell people who listen to this program love the natural world. They want to protect the natural world, but they may not know much about either the Everglades or the specific threats to the Everglades or the specific threats to wildlife habitat in Florida. So can you give us an introduction to that?
Well, the Everglades is obviously, a lot of people heard of the Everglades. It's got all kinds of iconic classifications. The Everglades National Park is a World Heritage Site. It's a World Heritage Site in danger. It's a wetland of international importance. It's the largest national park in the eastern United States, the largest wilderness area in the eastern United States. And it's not just the Everglades National Park. It's maybe a dozen major public lands that are down here that people think about when they think about the Everglades. It includes the Big Cypress Swamp, protected by the Big Cypress National Preserve, places like the Fakahatchee Preserve State Park. Some people refer to that as the Amazon of North America because of the incredible amount of biodiversity in that place, the Picayune State Forest, Audubon's Corkscrew Swamp, Biscayne National Park, the Coral Reefs, the 10,000 Islands National Wildlife Refuge. So one of the things when I give talks on the Everglades and South Florida in general, the first thing I do, and I can't do it with you because we're on radio, is I show them a map of South Florida. And even though the South Florida metropolitan area, and by that I mean Miami-Dade, Broward County, which people think of as Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach County, is the largest metropolitan area in the southeast United States. It's about 6 million people, and growing, by the way. It's a 20-mile wide strip that runs from Palm Beach down to about Homestead. And when you go west of that strip, you really are in the largest undeveloped piece of land in the eastern United States. If you look at a dark sky map of the United States, look at, you know, which basically shows the continent lit up at night where the lights are, you'll see this big black splotch over South Florida. Not on the East Coast, not so much on the West Coast anymore because that's where people are moving in, but in the center. And that's where the Everglades and the Big Cypress region is. So it's a gigantic flatland. It's pretty much flat. The Everglades technically begins south of Orlando. Many people have been to Orlando, don't realize that the Everglades begins in a place called the Kissimmee Chain of Lakes and kind of drains down into Lake Okeechobee, one of the largest freshwater lakes solely in a single state in the United States. And Lake Okeechobee is a big, shallow puddle. And historically, the lake would fill up in the rainy season. We're in the rainy season right now. And a wall, or we called it the River of Grass, would flow out over the south shore of Lake Okeechobee, 50 miles, 60 miles wide, all the way down to Florida Bay, and some of it into Biscayne Bay, forming some of the richest estuaries in the country. West of the Everglades proper is the Big Cypress region, not named Big Cypress because the cypress is so big. Actually, all the Big Cypress, the big trees, have been logged out, but because of the expanse of it, and it's the we also call it the Western Everglades. But both areas are extremely shallow. They're bordered on either side by a coastal ridge, and this tremendous wetland just flows in that area. I don't want to take too much time with the geography. I mean, I could really spend a long time, and it's kind of hard to do it without pictures. But if you picture just this, if you picture a spoon, a big spoon with little ridges on either side, and inside that spoon, that's the Everglades. A little bit higher up to the western side is the Big Cypress, and that's the Everglades. And then you got the estuaries to the south and to the east.
And tell me
and
a little.
That's good.
And tell me a little bit.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead, Derek.
So tell me a little bit about the wildlife and the fecundity, especially pre-contact. I've heard some absolutely extraordinary things about especially bird life and fish life in southern Florida from a long time ago. So can you tell me a little bit about what it used to be?
Yeah, that's an interesting point of view, and we only have a few references to it. Some of the Spanish explorers and some of the, Ponce de Leon, actually 1513 is officially the date of first contact, when Ponce de Leon was supposedly seeking out the Fountain of Youth in Florida. On his second trip to Florida, what he actually found was the poison arrow from one of the Calusa Indians that lived on the west coast of Florida, and they took him to Cuba where he died, so he hardly achieved his goal of finding the Fountain of Youth. But early explorers described a land just overflowing with wildlife, deer, panther, black bear, birds would blacken the sky. That's how it was described in various chronicles. And tremendous plant life as well, orchids, ferns, bromeliads, all kinds of palm trees, hammocks, cypress, related to redwoods, by the way. So you had this incredibly rich, biodiverse ecosystem, which is not that old, because the Everglades really isn't that old. Back during the last ice age, let's go back 10,000 years, when a lot of the fresh water was up in the glaciers, Florida, the sea level was about 200 feet lower, and Florida was kind of a high, cool plateau. And it was only about 5,000 years ago, 5,000 years, that's not very old, that Florida took its present shape and it became this warm, tropical, subtropical wetland that it is today. And it's all built on limestone, because throughout most of Florida's history, when it originally, they know from the basement rocks that it was once connected to Northwest Africa. And as the Atlantic Ocean widened out, when the continent of Pangaea split up, and Florida went with North America, throughout most of its history, it was a shallow sea. It was the bottom of a shallow sea. So it's all limestone, thousands of feet down, limestone, which is really just the fossilized remains of corals, and mostly corals, but other marine creatures. It's all fish meal. So you've got this limestone platform, not all that old, and yet you've got this tremendous biodiversity. And I would think there's few states in the country that actually have the biodiversity of South Florida. Dozens and dozens of listed species, endangered, threatened, state-listed species. And unfortunately, they're almost all threatened. We also have coral reefs here. We have mangroves. This is not something you see in other parts of the United States. So, the answer to the question is yes, it's a tremendous area. And you really have to spend some time on the internet, or better yet, walking through the swamps and looking at some of the stuff that's out here. If you go out, sometimes I go out with folks from the Native Plant Society. I have one friend in particular who used to be a director of the Miami group. And it's hard to walk 1,000 feet with him for all the different plants he's pointing out to me in the big cypress, and then testing me to see if I remember the names, which I often don't.
So what are some of the threats or problems faced by the larger Everglades, Big Cypress area?
Okay, well, there's a number of things we can touch on, but the first thing I'd like to talk about are the public lands, because that's what got me involved in this area to begin with. I mean, I'm a New Yorker. I didn't come down here to do this work. I actually came down here to do business, and I was very happy with that, but I did find something that I was a little bit better at, and that's being an environmental activist with the Everglades. But I first just started hiking out in the Big Cypress. I started going by myself, started going with friends, taking people out there. I was just astounded by it. Once I got over the fact I'm going to be dry, once I realized that hiking in South Florida was not going to be like hiking in New England or Alaska or Colorado, where you don't want to get wet because it could be cold. You can get cold at night and bad things can happen to you. Here, you walk through water and nothing happens. It cools you off. So once I got over that idea that you don't need to be dry to hike, suddenly the whole of South Florida was open to me. And I started hiking, doing swamp walks in the Big Cypress, taking people out. And initially that was my environmental work, was taking people out on the weekends to places like the Big Cypress National Preserve for swamp walks. As I got more involved with it, I realized that management issues in these tremendous public lands, and these are lands owned by the federal government, so it doesn't matter where people are listening to this program, this is part of your natural heritage. Big Cypress National Preserve is 720,000 acres. Everglades National Park is 1.5 million acres. They're contiguous. Put them together, that's 2.2 million acres. Biscayne National Park is right there. That's another 160,000 acres. The Loxahatchee. All these public lands are connected, and when you look at a public land map of South Florida, it's really one big green splotch with a 20-mile-wide strip on the East Coast, a strip on the West Coast. Everything else is owned by the federal government or the state. But how these lands are managed makes a big difference. In Big Cypress, there's a history of off-road vehicle use, which you can imagine running off vehicles in a wetland can do a tremendous amount of damage. In Everglades National Park, the estuary at the bottom of Florida is called Florida Bay, and tremendous amounts of damage has been done by motorboats because it's a very shallow bay. It could be 1-2 feet deep in places, and they've been basically rototilled. The seagrass beds have been rototilled by powerboats. Biscayne Bay has similar problems, also overfishing. Biscayne Bay is right near Miami, and many, many people fish, both commercial and recreational fishing, with hardly an idea that they're in a federal piece of land that's actually a national park and is supposed to have a higher level of protection. So all these different kinds of uses, off-road vehicle use, in addition to hunting and oil in the Big Cypress National Preserve, airboats and powerboats in Everglades National Park, powerboats and fishing in Biscayne National Park. These are heavy uses. These are high-impact activities on fragile wetlands and fragile marine ecosystems. In fact, several years ago, National Geographic Traveler did one of their destination scorecards, and they rated national park destinations throughout North America. And in some ways, not surprisingly, Big Cypress Everglades was ranked together because it's one contiguous piece of land. It was ranked bottom of the barrel in terms of the quality of the national park. And I think they gave two reasons for that. One was the gateway community, and that means lots and lots of development that's served these public lands in all kinds of ways, both in terms of the quality of water going into them, the quantity of water, also just not having a buffer zone, having so much development in South Florida has really created a difficult road for wildlife, who of course don't pay any attention whatsoever to the lines that we draw on a map. So Florida panthers, for example, and that's a big focus for our organization, there's about 150 left. Now this is the last big cat in the eastern United States. Florida panthers are cougar. It's a puma that was geographically isolated in South Florida when everything else got developed. So one time, cougars ranged throughout the entire eastern United States. Now they're only in Southwest Florida, and there's really nothing great about Southwest Florida for panthers because it's wet. The browse for deer is not very good. It's not the right vegetation. But panthers are here because until recently, it was the last large roadless area that an animal that has a tremendous range needs to survive. So when National Geographic did the study, I don't want to forget what I was saying, it's basically they gave it this very low ranking, both because of the amount of motorized recreation that takes place in Big Cypress Everglades National Park, as well as some of the others, but also the quality of the gateway community, the development, and what it does to the water and air quality.
You know, there's something that we always hear about, and, you know, you sent me an outline of some of the things you wanted to talk about, and this wasn't specifically on it, but I would like to ask about this. Yeah, I guess you did mention that the huge amount of ag and ranch lands that, you know, one of the things that I think most people have heard about in terms of threats to the Everglades is the whole Big Sugar thing. And
right.
do you want to talk about ag and ranching and the sort of what you called the gateway. You want to talk about that for a little while?
Well, sure. And that's a big topic. And it's far more, when I talk about the gateway, I'm talking more about lands right adjacent to some of the public lands. But when you get into the ag, and let's say ag and ranching, because the two go together. The Everglades was drained. The Everglades was drained. It was drained for flood control. There were some devastating hurricanes that happened down here in the 20s, another one in the 40s. And basically, the Army Corps of Engineers, for whom flood control is a major mission, basically drained the Everglades. I mean, drainage of the Everglades goes back to the 19th century. In fact, if you look at the historic documents, it's very hard to find anybody going back that far that thought that the drainage of the Everglades was not a good thing. Reclamation of worthless land fit only for Indians, mosquitoes, and alligators. Those are the kind of statements that were made. The governor of Florida, Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, ran in the 19th century under the, basically his platform was draining the Everglades. In 1850, that was a very important act that was passed at that time. It's called the Swamplands Act, which turned over to the new state of Florida 20 million acres of wetlands for the purpose of reclamation, or what they meant was development and drainage. So it has a long history here in South Florida. The idea that the Everglades as a wetland, as a swamp, was simply worthless, and the only way to put it to good use was to drain it. The drainage began with a man, Distin, from the Distin Steel Company, who actually managed to buy, I think it was 4 million acres of the Everglades for $1 million, 25 cents an acre, and started to drain it, started building the first canals in the 19th century. That process just kept going. Eventually, the Army Corps of Engineers undertook what was called the Central and Southern Florida Flood Control Project, which put in, I'm not sure the exact length of the canals, but almost creating a Venice out of South Florida. And the main canals go from Lake Okeechobee. Remember I said earlier that the water drains from the north, from central Florida, into Lake Okeechobee, and then out into the ocean. Instead of going down into the Everglades like it used to, that land, that water is now taken out the tide. And it's not just Big Sugar. A lot of people think, oh, the problem with the Everglades is Big Sugar. Big Sugar is a problem. It's about 700,000 acres south of Lake Okeechobee. But west of Lake Okeechobee, along what's called the Caloosahatchee River, another 450,000 acres, and it's mostly citrus and cattle, mostly citrus in that area. And citrus is a crop that requires a lot of fertilizer, a lot of pesticides. To the east, in St. Lucie County, you've also got a lot of citrus. To the north, between Lake Okeechobee and Orlando, a very big undeveloped area, about 2 million acres of cattle ranches. So Lake Okeechobee, going from this repository of fresh water that drained almost half the state, is now being drained, or now is now being filled with runoff from cattle ranches. When the water comes out of the lake, it no longer goes south. In fact, in the dike, that was one of the things that was put in the Central and Southern Florida Flood Control Project. The water can't move out of the lake. It's a complete dike. It's an above-ground swimming pool. That's what it looks like. And when the water, when the lake fills up, rather than sending it south into the sugar fields, which would flood the sugar fields, they send it to the east and west, the Caloosahatchee River to the west, to the St. Lucie Canal to the east. It's tremendous, tremendous flood of water. During heavy rains, that's where the water's going right now. And it's loaded with agricultural runoff from the cattle, from the citrus. It goes out to the St. Lucie. Last year, we had heavy rains. We had tremendous algae outbreaks in the estuaries, the Indian River Lagoon on the East Coast. The same thing happened on the West Coast. So the Everglades, which was at one time the repository or the recipient of all this beautiful fresh water, in places like Biscayne Bay, the flow of water through the Everglades, and a lot of it was underground through that porous limestone, was so great that sailors were able to actually lower buckets into parts of Biscayne Bay and pull up fresh water. That was the kind of outflow, the head pressure that the Everglades developed. Down to a trickle, much of the water was diverted to tide to drain these lands for all this agriculture and ranching. And the sugar is the first, you know, when the water finally does leave the lake, it's passing through the sugar fields before it gets into the public lands that I mentioned, places like Everglades National Park and what's called the water conservation areas north of that. So it's a very fragmented system compared to what it used to be. It's a highly degraded system because we no longer have the flow, and the water that does come in through the canal is loaded with agricultural runoff. And that's one of the problems where there's always tremendous controversy over what is the best way to restore the Everglades. And unfortunately, people keep hearing about Everglades restoration, and in theory, it's one of the biggest projects, restoration projects ever undertaken. Progress has been incredibly slow, incredibly slow. I'd say the two big controversies right now, or the one main controversy with two sides to it, is how do we get the quality of the water right? How do we get the quantity of the water right? And the Army Corps, South Florida Water Management District, are kind of they're leaning towards these massive impoundments where water is basically put away into these big above ground impoundments. The water is then put into stormwater treatment areas where it's cleaned and trickled into the Everglades. Other people think that the best way to do this is to strategically buy out some of the agricultural land, take out important swaths of the sugar lands, for example, and let natural wetlands return and let those wetlands do the work of cleaning the water as well as returning some of the habitat that's now gone and have a more natural kind of restoration.
And so you've mentioned agricultural runoff, and people talk about agricultural runoff a lot, but what... Okay, before we go on to the other issues, the other important issues you're raising, what is wrong with agricultural runoff? What does that actually do? Is it just too much cow poop or too much nitrogen fertilizer? What does it actually do to the wetlands?
Yeah, cow poop is one big problem. Fertilizer is another big problem. Nitrogen and phosphorus are the two elements that are usually mentioned the most. But what they do is create a completely unnatural water quality in a system that was always low nutrient. So in other words, the sawgrass, everybody thinks of the Everglades, they think of plains of sawgrass. Well, the sawgrass does not do well with nutrients at all, whereas cattails do. So a lot of the Everglades have been taken over by cattails, which is not the native plant of the Everglades. You also have the tree islands. The tree islands are these, we call them hammocks or tree islands, live oak, sable palm, some of the other mahogany trees and various tropical hardwoods that were part of these hammocks was where the terrestrial animals were able to create a life. And through the drainage, through the unnatural retention of water in these water conservation areas, the lack of flow is pretty much gone from the system right now. The tree islands have disappeared in many areas, and tree islands are what supported the panthers, the possums, black bears, otters. I mean, we had a whole lot of terrestrial wildlife that was able to use these and parts of the Everglades which are gone. Not as possibly, but much of it has disappeared, and a lot of it is disappearing. The drainage of the Everglades created unnaturally high soil, which allowed fires, there was always fires in the Everglades. But as long as that underlying soil was moist, it never really got going. And now we have fires that can wipe out the tree islands. Or the tree islands get flooded by unnaturally high levels of water. But it's also, if the nitrogen, the phosphorus, leads to the wrong kinds of plants growing in the Everglades. We also have tremendous problem with invasive plant species. I was just out at a place called the Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge a few weeks ago because they opened up an alligator hunt there for the first time in their history. And that was disappointing because it's a well-known wildlife viewing area, specifically to view alligators. But the amount of invasives in the Loxahatchee was just tremendous. In fact, walking out on the levee for a few miles, you saw almost nothing that was native. You see these big fans of Melaleuca. We have this Lagodium, an old world climbing vine, which has covered tree islands, literally covered it, about a 3-foot dense. And underneath that mat, that's where the tree islands are. Brazilian pepper, all these plants were brought in to the Everglades for one reason or another, and they've just gone wild. So that's another problem in addition to the agricultural runoff. The agricultural runoff is bad in all kinds of ways, not only to the Everglades proper, but also to...
You're talking about the runoff is problems not only for the actual Everglades, but, and then that's the last thing I heard.
Right. So the runoff is a problem. You know, it's kind of hard to cover the whole ecosystem, you know, in a short conversation, but offshore, you've got coral reefs, you've got seagrass beds, and these are incredibly important biodiverse parts of the South Florida ecosystem. Runoff is bad for all of it. Runoff is bad for the coral reef because it covers the corals with a silt. It brings in microorganisms that the coral reefs are particularly susceptible to. The seagrass beds also require lots of light and clean water, and seagrass beds are literally, it's grass growing, you know, submerged in the estuaries, and that's where all the young fish are. It's habitat, it's a place for predators to hang out, marine predators to hang out, and the runoff does find its way through that canal system we talked about that was originally put in place to drain the Everglades. That's where the runoff goes, ultimately. Sometimes people talk about, well, the Everglades is our water supply, and that's true. The Biscayne Aquifer, which is a surficial aquifer, when you're out in the Everglades and you see water on the surface, that is, in fact, the drinking water. But we, as human beings, have the ability to do something that the ecosystem doesn't. We have these massive water filtration plants. So every municipality in South Florida, as they take their water up through well fields, is able to filter the water, and they can filter it to whatever extent is necessary. So it's somewhat true. I mean, it is true that the Everglades is the water supply for the 6 million people that live in Southeast Florida, but it's also true that the filtration ability is there to allow people to have fresh water. The problem is for the wildlife, for the ecosystem, they don't get the benefit of that kind of filtration. I mean, we're talking about a massive amount of water, and it's the natural water, and unfortunately, it's loaded with the runoff and pesticides. So it's creating all kinds of problems.
So I would like to talk about energy and the Everglades, but before I do that, I want to say one thing about runoff that, or about nutrients that really brought home the agricultural runoff problem on a very personal level, which is I live in a coastal rainforest in Northern California, and there's a lot of bears here. There's also a lot of moss, and moss likes low nutrients and can't stand high nutrients. And bears oftentimes when they will pee as they walk, and so you can see a trail of pee on the dirt. And if they're walking through moss when they pee, you can then see a few weeks later a trail of dead moss from that follows their pee line. And it's because it was acidic, and that's all it takes is one time peeing right on moss to kill it. So I think about that in terms of the very specific nutrient requirements and soil requirements of various plants. It's just been a great example for me in what I see every day.
That is a good example. It's really unfortunate. I got to tell you, when I drive around South Florida, including the Everglades, including those ranch lands north of the lake, it's just amazing to me how much of it, I'm not talking about suburban or urban development, I'm talking about kind of rural development, how little of the original ecosystem is left, and just physically how disturbed it is. And when you see the amount of land that's being fertilized and treated with pesticides, and the extent of it, it could be, let's use the word daunting, you know, trying to figure out how to clean this up without taking some of this land out of production. And in cases where land has been taken out of production in the Everglades, in places like I was at a place called the Dupuy Reserve just about a month ago. I had a friend in from D.C. and wanted to see some of the Everglades, and we went there. I'd never been there before. And this was an old ranch. And the ranch had been turned back over to the state and allowed to go native. And now it was pine flatwoods. And it was incredible what it looked like. And I think that for our organization, South Florida Wildlands Association, that's what we really stress, is natural kinds of restoration. And yeah, taking some of that land, especially in key areas, out of agricultural production, instead of leaving it in production and trying to do all kinds of complicated engineering fixes to clean the water up. You take the water out of, you take the land out of production, you're getting an immediate decrease in the load, the nutrient load. You're bringing back habitat, and you're getting the water purification ability of a natural wetland. So there's all kinds of good reasons for doing it. Unfortunately, when you bring this up to the Army Corps of Engineers, and as I did in a meeting last year, and the response was, well, the purpose of the Central and Southern Flood Control Project was, amongst other things, economic development. And they stress that. They will stress the, you know, the fact that creating agricultural lands, creating lands for development, was in fact the purpose of the drainage project to begin with. So stressing the need to bring back habitat kind of works against that. And that's one of the big problems we have with regard to the Everglades. Just not agreeing on a vision, you know, just the agencies, a lot of the environmental groups are just not seeing things the same way. But let's go on to energy, because that's a big topic too.
Well, and I want to thank you for what you just said. And I think that's incredibly important and something that we see. You know, I find it absolutely extraordinary, given the assaults on wild nature, I find it a huge testament to the resilience of the real world that anybody is surviving at all. And it's, I just find it how absolutely extraordinary that if you leave a piece of land alone, how much it wants to come back to what it was.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
And it brings me to tears often just to think about, if you just get the off-road vehicles off and you stop cutting the trees, what do you know? A forest starts to emerge again. What a surprise.
Right. And they found that over and over again. You know, in my native New York with the Hudson River, when they stopped dumping the chemicals into the Hudson River, it was amazing. And it shocked scientists how fast the Hudson River ecosystem recovered. It's still a hurting ecosystem, but it did clean up fast. I mean, the Hudson is washed by tides twice a day. The tides go all the way up from New York Bay all the way up into Albany. And that combination did its work. And we could do the same thing, you know, we could do the same thing in the Everglades. But it has to start with the vision. It has to start with the vision. I'm always thinking about, have you ever read about the wolf-free introduction into Yellowstone National Park? Familiar with that?
Yeah,
that project. And
yeah, I'm very familiar with that.
Because I think of that often. I mean, here was a top predator that was removed, physically removed. I mean, there was a certain point where the National Park Service had made a decision that the predators were going to go because they were interfering with the tourists' ability to see the elk and things like that. And they basically did predator removal. And the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone National Park had this incredible cascade effect. Suddenly, yeah, the elks were in better shape because they had a predator, their natural predator, that they had to become aware of, but they were moving away from the rivers. The willows came back. The beavers came back because the young willows were there that the elks had been eating. And because the beavers were there, they started creating dams. And the dams were good for the fish. So you had this tremendous restoration just from putting one species back into the system. And I think that people did these kinds of things, like I said, in the Everglades. It's amazing how the historical record shows almost nobody saying, wait a minute, maybe drainage of this ecosystem isn't such a good idea. But, I mean, I can talk about this at length. I think Florida, given that it's 20 million people, roughly 20 million people right now, it is, I think, officially the third largest state in the country now after California, number one, Texas, number two. We either have surpassed or are going to surpass New York State this year. And according to a report called Wildlife 2060, which is based on the assumption that by the year 2060, Florida will have grown to about 36 million people. We are going to conduct an experiment in Florida, I think, which is, can people survive without the natural world? And I think that's the experiment that's underway right now, because the natural world in Florida, this tremendous biodiverse, subtropical, tropical, temperate piece of the world, is under threats from so many sources, including habitat loss, because that 36 million population is based on the idea that 7 million additional acres of natural or even agricultural land, which is not great, but it does support wildlife better than urban and suburban areas, is going to happen. And I see it all around me. And as I travel around the state, it's not just the ag. The development is back, the track housing, the strip malls. People live in these kind of cul-de-sac communities, and they do their shopping in strip malls. I mean, not strip malls, but these massive outdoor malls that are built. And they just crop up, and people see them cropping up. And for most of the population, if they were born and raised here, they just kind of shake their heads. They've seen it all. For the new people, it's just what Florida is. And there's just not that many people down here who have enough of a vision, it seems, to think that, well, the natural world has some importance. And as far as the population, I think their experience is you can live without the natural world. I mean, go to the beach, you know, lay down, get a tan, go to a restaurant. I mean, that's the beach. Go home, go to a ball, do your shopping. I mean, what do they need nature for? That's really, that's the hard sell down here. I mean, you've got to sell people on the idea that these natural areas that they never go out to, are important, because it seems that, they don't, it's not a part of their everyday life. And there's a big disconnect to the majority of the population and these incredible wetlands that Florida is really famous for. So energy, we were talking about energy. You have a specific question? Yeah, we were talking about a lot of things. I know, Derek.
No, it's great. It's all very important stuff. And I mean, everything you were just saying is, I think, very important. And also, of course, was breaking my heart, as I'm sure breaks yours. Let's talk about, we have like 8 minutes left or so, something. So can we talk about energy for a minute? And then I would like to talk about you have talked about vision, so I would like to talk about the energy problem, and then I would like to talk about your vision, and then we'll wind up after that.
Okay. So energy, in the last year, energy has gotten a tremendous amount of attention in Florida, because few people knew that there is a oil-bearing formation in Southwest Florida, the Big Cypress area that I talked about, ground zero for the Florida Panther. It's been a low-level producing area since the 1940s, but it's all owned. The mineral rights are owned by one company. It's Collier Resources, and Collier County. Anybody who lives in Florida has heard of Collier County. Is named after a gentleman by the name of Baron Giff Collier, who came down here in the early 20th century and bought up over 1 million acres of Southwest Florida, everything from Fort Myers down to Marco Island. And as he and the family divested of the properties in one way or another, whether they sold them to private enterprises or sold them to public, the National Park Service, for example, or the state of Florida, they retained the mineral rights on all these lands. So today they still own over 800,000 acres of mineral rights. And about May of 2013, that's when we first started hearing about it, they decided to go all in on these mineral rights and started bringing in oil drillers and seismic testing operations to drill. And we've had a lot of, it's been a good chunk of my last year. I did a lawsuit against one of the companies that were brought in, the Hughes Oil Company, that had leased 115,000 acres of land. Most of the public lands I've talked about, pieces of the public lands, including a piece of private land less than a mile from the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. And that was enough to bring me into the fight. I ended up filing a lawsuit against the company and the DEP for having done the permit without due consideration to wildlife issues. And kind of a long story, but the community was up in arms about it. It was not only near the Panther Refuge, it was also near a community called Golden Gate Estates. And the combination of environmental activists and community activists really put a lot of pressure on. Eventually, Collier County got involved, and the Hughes company quit the lawsuit. So I won. They quit. That's one way of winning a lawsuit. So that one's done. The Hughes company is still kind of around. There's other companies that have leased gigantic swaths of land for seismic testing, where one company wants to do blasting just north of the Big Cypress Preserve and the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge to figure out what's down there, you know, before they start drilling their wells. Another company has leased, well, originally it was about 235,000 acres. I think they're lowering that now to do a different kind of seismic testing using these, what they call vibrosized trucks, where they drive over the area and the truck kind of lowers this big steel plate onto the ground and vibrates and sends vibrations down about 2 miles or more to figure out where the oil-bearing formations are. And then, of course, it's followed up by oil drilling, which means roads, gravel roads come in, oil pads come in, thousands and thousands of cubic yards of fill material, machinery, drill rigs, deep well injection wells to take the stuff that comes out of the well, the drilling fluids. There was a lot of, we can't really get into it right now, but there's fracking, a kind of a fracking-like activity that's been going on down here where they pump the acid down into these horizontal wells that they drill to kind of loosen up the formation, get the oil flow. So that's just an ongoing battle. And unfortunately, the lands that the Colliers own, Collier Resources owns, is the sensitive public lands in southwest Florida, the Big Cypress, Nacogdoches, Picayune, all of it, habitat for the panther, black bears, eastern indigo snakes. Actually, maybe the most biodiverse piece of land in the continental United States. That's what the botanist for the Big Cypress National Preserve has called it. You really have to get out into this land to see how rich it is in biodiversity. And even when you're not seeing the wildlife, seeing the tracks, seeing the plants, it can test anybody's taxonomic knowledge to be able to identify everything they're seeing out there. So that's the oil situation. And of course, you've got our utility company, our sole utility, Florida Power and Light, FPL, building two new nuclear reactors on the shores of Biscayne Bay, right on the shores of Biscayne Bay, right away, in land that every climate scientist is saying is not going to be land all that much longer. In order to get the juice north to the population areas and to get it into the grid, they want to run three massive power lines along the side of eastern side of Everglades National Park, and requesting the National Park Service turn over the eastern side of Everglades National Park to them for that purpose. And they'll swap out an old unused utility corridor they have inside the park that they've never given up and never been forced to give up, as they should have. North of the Big Cypress, in some of the most important primary panther habitat in the state, FPNL has plans to build one of the largest gas-fired or fossil fuel-powered plants in the country. Three units, I think 1,250 megawatts each. It's 3,750 megawatts. Natural gas plant there in Hendry County, north of the preserve, north of the Seminole Reservation, and right in the middle of some of the best upland habitats for panthers that are left. So those three fights right there, I mean, against the FPNL plus the oil drilling, and there's always offshore. I mean, that Sunnyland trend where the Colliers own the it's kind of a northwest to southeast running trend. It extends out. People believe it extends out into the Gulf. And there's always a push to open up Florida's state waters as well as federal waters beyond the state limit to offshore drilling. We've managed to keep that stopped for now, but the plan is always there to do it. So, in fact, I guess the Florida legislature back in 2010, had the BP disaster not happened in the Gulf, we probably would have close inshore drilling in Florida because it was coming. And it was only the BP disaster that put it up on the shelf. But, you know, people have the memories that they have, so we'll see how long we're able to keep the offshore away from Florida. And that's energy in the nutshell.
So what is your, we have like 3 or 4 minutes left. So can you take like two mm-hmm. minutes to talk about your own, given the current existence of this horrible culture and given that, presuming that it doesn't collapse in the next 20 years, what is your vision to try to protect as much of the region as you can? What is your goal?
Well, as you can tell from this conversation, I feel like I just came out of the trenches to do this interview, and then I go back in. And I do go back in as soon as this interview is over. I've got emails I've got to write to the Fish and Wildlife Commission trying to get some data from them about deer in the Big Cypress area. It's a good question. I mean, I'm involved heavily in lots and lots of these fights, and I'm willing to take on the decision makers. In the process, I try as much as I can to educate the public. I've got a very active Facebook page. South Florida Wildlife Association has a Facebook page with, we reached over 10,000 followers in the last few weeks. I try to give talks when I can. I take opportunities to talk with folks like you on radio, and less common in TV, sometimes in print. Try to get the word out there to the people that understand that, why do we need biodiversity? You know, I've been asked one time, why do we need panthers? I mean, how do you answer that question?
Really,
how would you answer that question? You know, it's like somebody says to you, what do we need panthers for? I mean, do they need it for their life? I mean, what's the need of a panther? I mean, the panther, oh, go ahead. I mean, what's your thought about that? I'm curious.
Well, my thought is I'm not usually very generous. When somebody says, so why do we need salmon? I almost always say, well, why do we need you? And I just turn
good
it
answer.
Back.
Why do we need you? That's kind of cute.
And it's like, who cares if I got this the other day. Who cares if salmon die? I said, well, first off, forests care if salmon die, and rivers care, and bears care because they eat them. And, you know, I went on with that. And then I said, well, by the way, who cares if you die? And because I just hate that notion of people saying, you know, who cares if Florida panthers survive, or why do we need them? It's like, frankly, the Everglades need Florida panthers more than they need human beings. Here's the real point, is they need Florida panthers, the Everglades need Florida panthers more than they need human beings who don't need Florida panthers. That's the real point. And
that's,
So anyway, what I would like to do to end here is to ask what people who hear this interview can do to support you in your work and to support the Everglades if they are A, in your region, or B, if they are not in your region. What can people do to help this struggle?
Well, I hate to say this, but money always helps. The lawsuit I talked about against the Dan Hughes Company, the oil well next to the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, I didn't have the funds for a lawyer. I did it myself. I was pro se. So I represented myself in court, and that was not easy. Money is always helpful for legal battles, and unfortunately, that's how we have to do a lot of this. We also need it for the travel, for the research that we do, hiring people to do some of that research, because you really have to make your claims based on science and not opinion. So the science is a big part of what we do, as well as law. So money is always helpful. Coming onto our Facebook page, I mean, I've discovered that Facebook is a great community for people to participate, learn about what's going on, share their opinions. We're trying to develop a website. I have a basic website. It needs a lot more work. And if they're in the area, a donor did provide enough funds to pay for insurance, which will allow me to do an outings program this year as the weather cools off and come out on some of these outings. I mean, get to know some of the wild areas in South Florida and understand the difference between a wild area and a golf course or a county park or a shopping mall. See what's here. I mean, every time I've done that, taking people out to these natural areas, it's something you can't really put in words. In a place, in a wilderness area, where nature, the natural world predominates, I think that's a great way to understand why we need panthers, why we need crested caracaras, why we need all the things that what people call the real Florida, why we still need the real Florida, and what a huge loss for the planet it would be, and it will be, if we keep going down the road we're going. That's what I said earlier. I said, it's kind of an experiment. Can people live without not just panthers, but virtually all of nature? Because that's the direction we're headed here. With 36 million people in the state sprawled out over virtually all the natural lands and creating little islands out of the remaining public lands, it's pretty hard to imagine wildlife doing very well in that new world we're creating. So to me, that's a nightmare that should be avoided at all costs. And yet what I see is our decision makers not running away from it, but kind of embracing it and trying to figure out, well, where's the development going to go? And there's so many development projects down here. We didn't even mention them. I mean, the expansion of the Port of Miami, expansion of Port Everglades, new railroad, railroads being built, but many, many new highways planned, crisscrossing, networking the entire state, expansion of Fort Lauderdale Airport going on right now everywhere, Port Canaveral. So there's development going on again everywhere in Florida, and it's all built around people are coming. We have to be ready for them. And not only does that destroy the natural ecosystem, but what kind of quality of life do people have here? I read an article yesterday that Lee County, Fort Myers area, I forgot the number of pedestrian and bicycle fatalities, but Florida is number one by far in the country for people getting killed by bikes and people being killed walking or on bicycles in Florida. There's too many roads. The roads are too big. There's just no place for anything but cars and highways. And we're creating, I can't help it. I mean, I feel like we're turning Florida into this one gigantic strip mall. And people who live down here, people that know that these lands are part of a natural heritage, a national heritage, a lot of them are federally owned, should, you know, take advantage when they hear about a story, write Obama, write the director of the National Park Service, write Sally Jewell in the Department of Interior. And I think that when people really, and demonstrate when there's, you know, opportunities to do that as well, you know, just come out, make your voice heard that wildlife, nature are important. And I've had a lot, and we didn't really talk about it, but I've stopped a lot of projects. I have stopped a lot of projects or been part of efforts to stop a lot of these development projects. And every single one of them had the same formulas that people came out. People came out. They made noise. In addition to the legal stuff. The legal stuff is good, but nothing is more important than large numbers of people coming out in one way or another, whether it's online or coming out to a demonstration or anything like that, and making some noise and letting decision makers know that know what they want. You know, be heard. That's important.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming out of the trenches to speak with me and with the listeners today. And I want to, before we go, I want to make a plea here. If there's somebody listening who is an attorney in Florida who would like to do some good work for the Everglades, I think we might have an opportunity for you. Anyway, so thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Matt Schwartz. This is Derek Jensen from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.